that does the actual building affect or even determine behavior? And we looked at instances that are pretty dramatic where you'd have to say, wow, that's an amazing impact that architecture had on people's lives. You know, the example I gave of the married student housing at MIT where Fessenden, Schachter, and Back did this study, and my God, people's friendship formation, it all had to do with the way the thing was freaking laid out. And that was a big determinant of their social life when they were in college. And we talked about, you know, this is, it can affect learning in schools, it can affect health in hospitals, it can affect, you know, social relationships in college campuses and all in neighborhoods everywhere. But we kind of came down to this notion that it isn't so much a one-to-one relationship between you build a certain architectural form and people will have a certain behavior. It's a much more loose fit than that. And we talked about it in three ways, that there are conforming uses, which is pretty predictable. That's likely going to happen. And then there are implied uses, where, yeah, there's a suggestion that would happen. And then there are accommodated uses, which are a wide range of things that maybe you could not imagine, but in fact, the architecture accommodates that pretty well. And then we looked at a number of examples, Baker House and new student housing at MIT, two different ways of approaching how student life would be encouraged on a college campus. And then the final building we looked at, and unfortunately I was a little rushed on that one, but this incredible monastery at La Tourette, where they're taking an order of Catholic priests that were not accustomed to being cloistered, and they're trying to help them completely change their lifestyle. Instead of being priests in a parish that help their parishioners, instead, the idea that they would only have a communion with God, that they would be a singular human being on earth, having communion only with God, no social life, just a connection to God. How could you build an environment that encouraged people to eschew materialism, eschew comfort, eschew even appreciation of the natural environment? So that you really wall them off, separate them, contain them, and then really the one moment of kind of emotion or connection to something else comes in the chapel. And that moment when you're saying the Mass or when you're saying your prayers or you're hearing the chants, that is the moment of some real connectedness. Otherwise, you're inside yourself. You're in your cell. You're contemplating, you're reading, you're praying. And a building that was really meant to engender that way of thinking and way of living. And in fact, it's powerful as hell. When I visited that building, I went with a friend, and you know, he just got kind of extremely uncomfortable and had to leave. It was just too strange. It was just not a place where he felt comfortable sleeping and staying. And it is a very, very powerful environment, maybe the most deterministic environment I've ever experienced, where you kind of have to do what the building tells you to do. But even then, it's not a one-to-one fit. So those two lectures, the one on designation organization of use and the one on architectural determinism, in a way, they're flip sides. Designation organization use is about form follows function. So we have a certain function we're accommodating, and we make a form that does that. And then the architectural determinism lecture is almost function follows form. You build a certain form, and it begins to imply behavior that comes out of that. So those were a bit of a pair. Then we had this video on Frank Gehry, and we're going to be looking more at Gehry. That video was placed here to begin to make you think about issues of form and issues of human factors. How do those relate to each other? So obviously, Frank Gehry is an architect very interested in form. And he's super famous for these wild-ass crazy forms that he makes. But I'm interested, and it's there in the video, in his reaction also to human input and function and how that generates form. And we'll be dealing with that more explicitly in a subsequent lecture where we'll look at some of Gehry's work, not in terms of form, but in terms of human factors. But before we get to that, we're gonna lay a little groundwork here for another attitude about where architectural form comes from, and one maybe that is more about architectural form coming from issues related to human factors. So we're going to be talking this time and on Thursday about humanism. And humanism is a long-standing kind of doctrine in many, many disciplines, in literature, in philosophy, and there are humanistic studies even as majors at some universities, where you look at this notion of humanism in many, many expressions. So I'm going to give you a dictionary definition of humanism. And there are four parts to it. First, maybe it's good to just listen to the whole definition, and then we'll break it down into four parts. So the dictionary says it's a doctrine or attitude centered on human interests or values. It's a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind and his capacity for self-realization through reason. So this is a notion that it was developed originally in the Renaissance, and an idea that human beings are the center of the world and that we need to optimize the performance of human beings. So the four parts of this are that it's a doctrine or attitude centered on human interests and values. How can we, whether it's in literature, in film, or in philosophy, how can we think of centering on human interests and values? A second point the definition makes is that it asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. That what is primary here is the dignity and worth of mankind. A third aspect of it is it emphasizes the capacity for self-realization. That all of us as human beings are trying to optimize our experience on the world, our self-realization, our self-actualization. And how do we emphasize that capacity human beings have for self-realization? And then that is accomplished, the fourth point, through reason, through something that is logical, that is analytical. And maybe this particular human characteristic of being thoughtful, logical, and analytical. So, 4 points. Centered on human interests and values. Second point, asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. Third point, emphasizes the capacity for self-realization. Fourth point, does that through reason. So, if you're thinking of that in terms of philosophy, it engenders something like democracy, where you really believe that individual human beings should have a right to determine their future, and they should have a say in how they're organized as a society. So that philosophy has engendered political, philosophical, literary directions for centuries now. So we're going to be looking at the application of this notion of humanism to architecture or to city building. We'll look at it at a personal scale today, and we'll look at it at a more urban scale on Thursday. And I'm going to make the argument that the way this translates into buildings is that there are 6 things that we normally find in buildings that are aimed toward humanism. So one is that we think of things that have primarily plain materials. So humanism, because it's really this sort of fundamental, it's about authenticity, it's about things that are genuine and the things that are just literally helpful to you. It's not very showy, and generally it uses plain materials. The second thing is that it generally uses sensible construction. That's this logical, practical, you know, sensible construction. A third thing is that it emphasizes comfort. We're trying to assert the dignity and worth of mankind, and that is often reflected in comfort. A fourth characteristic is practicality, that it is functional. It helps people accomplish goals they want to accomplish, do things they want to do. It's practical. The fifth thing is cleanliness and healthfulness, that it actually nurtures a good, clean, healthy human life. And the sixth thing is absence of pretension. So this notion is that I'm not trying to show you what a badass, cool guy I am. I'm at a more genuine level than that. So there would be the absence of pretension. So those six things, plain materials, sensible construction, comfort, practicality, cleanliness slash healthfulness, and an absence of pretension. Now, how would that look or play out in, let's just say, general attitudes about the things we have? So I would say that many of you are bought into humanism in the way you dress. You're dressing in a way that's very practical, very comfortable, that it helps you do the things you do in your daily life very well. Something like blue jeans are a remarkably humanist kind of garb. They're tough and they're durable, they're comfortable, they're flexible, they're, you know, appropriate for many different kinds of activities. I would say blue jeans are a humanist kind of invention of mankind, and maybe that's why they're so popular all over the world. They really do what pants are supposed to do. Another really great example would be a wine bottle. And there's a whole article, a beautiful article, on an appreciation of wine bottles that was written in the 1920s from exactly this point of view. Made of very plain materials, just glass. Very sensible the way it's made. Very practical in the shape of it has everything to do with our hand and the diameter of it to grabbing that and holding it. So it's reflecting really the human body. The whole purpose of it is to pour wine out so that we're able to tilt it, and then it funnels to a smaller radius, and then it pours into the glass. Very practical that way, less spill. Even the little lip on the end of it has to do with stopping the drip as you pour it into the wine glass. Pretty much everything about a wine bottle is about this kind of humanistic notion, how it interacts with our body, how it accomplishes a simple thing we want done, and does it in the most practical, comfortable kind of way. So we're really going to be looking today at buildings that embody some of these qualities of blue jeans and wine bottles. Now, this is an aesthetic. There are formal implications to this. That maybe are very different from analyzing something purely on the basis of form. And early in the semester, we were looking at just what makes something beautiful. But this is a notion that somehow things become beautiful because they are practical. They become beautiful, something we can appreciate with our mind, with reason, because they help us accomplish things in our lives. And, you know, if you just look in an abstract way at beauty, there are very few fashion designers historically that would have made something like blue jeans. It's much more about, in fact, often very uncomfortable clothes that are sort of haute couture or really form-based clothes. But blue jeans are what we want to live in and operate in. And there's a certain kind of beauty and aesthetic appreciation that comes from that as well. So let's think about how these things might be applied to more visual objects. And we're going to start with a kind of smaller scale. Whoops. Oh, good. So let's talk about furniture at the beginning here. So I would make the argument, that the piece of furniture on the left, which is called a high board, is not a particularly humanist piece of furniture. And the piece of furniture on the right is a very humanist piece of furniture. The piece of furniture on the left is like a haute couture gown. The piece of furniture on the right is more like a pair of blue jeans. So let's analyze the one on the left by those various qualities we talked about earlier. It is not plain materials. It's very fancy materials. It's made of exotic inlaid woods that came from a long way away, are very precious, and are then cut and inlaid into each other in what's called intarsia, that is very, very difficult to do. And then you have to kind of appreciate the craftsmanship, but there are all these scenes of kind of Chinese landscapes that are all embedded in the wood. So it is not plain materials. It is also not simply made. It's a lot of very labor-intensive and very difficult craftsmanship to make all of these funky little things. It is certainly not about comfort or about practicality. It's meant to be a place to store your clothes, and there are drawers here. The handles to the drawers are like little flowers, but in fact, very difficult to get your fingers in and get this little metal loop and pull it out. It's actually very uncomfortable to do that. Also, kind of idiot thing. I mean, my eye height is about right here on this. Some people's eye height would be about right here. Can you imagine trying to get something out of those drawers? You know, you're pulling the drawer out, you can't see into the drawer. You're kind of taking your hand, reaching around, is that socks or is that underwear? It's ridiculous. Extremely impractical and uncomfortable. It's got a zillion little gewgaws that just catch dust, and so it's actually hard to keep kind of clean and healthy. And then it's got all of this kind of pretension and ornament. Seashells, God only knows what seashells have to do with storing your socks and underwear. These little urns that don't actually hold anything. Legs that look like the claws of a lion or something, and these little drippy things. It's, in a certain way, it's beautiful in a strictly formal sense. But in terms of humanism, does it really respond to its function and its role? Is it logical and reasonable? Absolutely not. Now, contrast that with the high boy over here, which is a similar function of a piece of furniture. This one, on the other hand, has all these drawers nice down low where I can pull them out. The leverage of my body pulling the drawer is good. I can see down into it. I can get whatever I need out of it. Those drawers at the bottom are deeper because I can pull them out farther and see into them better than it is up above. They've got these nice little wooden knobs on them that I can hold and pull out nicely. It's made of very plain material. This is made out of oak, very hard wood. And this is a piece, that one on the left is 18th century, this one is 19th century on the right. Both of these have been around a long time. The one on the right also is very practically made. It's made out of boards, and you see how you saw boards and you put them together at right angles, and it's very sensible construction. The top up here where there are open shelves, and then there are cabinet doors that shut and cover up whatever stuff you have up there, and keep it clean and not dusty. The cabinet fronts here, instead of being hinged on the side, they're hinged at the bottom, so they would flip up and cover up these shelves. Or when they flip down, they then rest on that little ledge that is what makes the drawers deeper here, and they make a table. So you can pull up a chair and you can write and do your business, and you've got little cubbies here for your papers and your pens and ink, and everything extremely well organized and functional. Very practical, very comfortable, everything worked out thoughtfully. And reason, logic. What do I need to do? How do I accomplish it? How is it made? How is that simply done?
How is it durable? How is it practical? All those things are driving the humanism in the high boy on the right. So these are very different ways to think about the aesthetics of a building or a piece of furniture in this case. So, all right, let's go back. So let's look at that chair on the right here. This one is exquisite. Oh my God, this one is such a beautifully designed chair. Now you might just look at it and say, I like that chair. That's a cool looking chair. And that's just an analysis of form. But if you actually think through that chair, it is so damn beautiful. So the back legs have a different role than the front legs, because when you sit your butt in a chair, the real weight is on the back legs. That's where your torso is putting the weight down. So they're chunky legs, and they splay out to give more stability. Bigger at the base than it is up above, so it's more stable. So you won't teeter on the chair. You can even sort of lean back, and you're not gonna tip over. So that move is very practical. The front legs are very different. They're smaller because they're taking less weight. They're really just kind of stabilizing the chair here, and they don't need that splay out because you're not pushing weight in this direction. They've got a little thickening at the bottom where they hit the ground so that there's a little more there to take that load into the ground. There are these very practical little straps that tie the four legs together so that they share the load mutually, and so they won't, you know, splay out individually. The front legs, because they're a little skinnier, when they get up to intersect with the seat, they need to thicken up because the loads are being carried here and it gets thicker there and then moves down into the leg. The seat itself is wood. It's strong all the way around. But in the middle, you don't really want your soft buns sitting on that hard wood, especially over a period of time. Ugh, doesn't feel good. So you change material. And now it's made out of a kind of woven reed. And that woven reed is put together in such a way that it's slightly concave, just as your butt is slightly convex, so your butt fits right into the shape of that seat. And it has a little give. It's a little softer than if it were made out of wood. The back goes up stronger here until it intersects the arms. And then above that, it's got less load, so it gets to be thinner as it goes up like that. Tall enough so that it supports your shoulders and your head. So if you want to lean back, you've got some support there. The arms, they sort of bow out and then back in, and they're rounded at the end. The rounded at the end just fits the shape of your hand at the end of that arm there. The bowing out is just like your elbows as they bow out, so that your arm sits on that just in the most natural way your arm wants to be at rest. Just like your body. It's not like this. That's not how you sit. You sit like this, and the chair acknowledges that. This is beautiful 19th century humanist design of a chair that is responding to all of those things of practicality and comfort and self-actualization and reason and logic and all of those things really driving the design. Now let's take it a step further into architecture. This is a whole village called Canterbury Village in New Hampshire. This is a Shaker village. The Shakers were a cult, a sect, in New England in the 19th century. And they were a little wacko, but they also were, they were amazingly humanist. So in the 19th century in New England, when a child was orphaned, and there wasn't a family member that could take care of that child, the child would generally be sent to the Shakers. And the Shakers would take in any orphan child, and they didn't just have a benevolent society or an orphanage or something like that. They took these children and they placed them right in their homes, and they treated them like they were their own children. These were generous, benevolent, good-hearted people who would take someone else's child who was orphaned and would absolutely make it their own child. So they were famous in New England for this. They also had, they were very industrious, good, hardworking people, and they made clothes. That was their major industry. They made, in particular, sweaters. And even into the 20th century, you can occasionally see a Shaker sweater. They were extremely durable. They lasted forever. They were super warm because it was a cold climate there. They were just beautifully made, practical, sensible sweaters. So that's the ethic of these people. How does that translate into their architecture? Let's look at those areas I was talking about. Very simple materials. They're just collecting the stones around on the site, and they're building the lower part of the building out of stone. Very practical to put the stone there because stone interfaces with the ground well. It comes out of the ground. It's accustomed to the moisture. It's strong and it's durable. It makes a great foundation. So very practical local stone there. Then above that, they can transition into wood. Again, tons of forest all the way around in New Hampshire. They harvest the forest. They make it into boards. They make the boards into a frame house. And very, very sensible construction of those plain materials. Then in addition to that, they're thinking about comfort. Their homes are very simple, but they're also very comfortable. They make all their own furniture. It's generally made out of wood. Very practical. That there'd be a low table. That's where you sit and you work. There would be a high table. That's where you stand and you work. This room would have been both it's sort of the kitchen and the workroom. You know, when you think of their life in the 19th century, this is a very nice combination of things, more for the women in the family, but it was where they did the cooking and they did the ironing and they did making some of these sweaters. And so they have a big open room that is for all of those functions in one space. And they're working at home. They don't have a workplace and a home place. They're taking care of the children. They're doing some work in this practical place. The cleanliness and healthfulness, everything is super, super clean. One example of that would be these chairs. And the chairs are very lightweight. So you can pick up the chair and you actually can hang it on the wall upside down like that. So you can absolutely clean the floor completely. No dust bunnies under any chairs. Everything is perfectly flexible, movable, practical, easily cleaned. And that's what the interiors of their houses were like. The exterior, they're just expressing those boards that it's made out of, the timber, a big, heavy corner that covers the intersection, the two boards coming at a joint where water could penetrate. You put a nice, big, heavy board over that. Same way around the windows. The trim actually has to do with sealing the joint to make sure that no water can penetrate where the window occurs. I love this building on the right. That's actually a building for storing wood. They're in freaking New Hampshire. It's freezing cold in the wintertime. You have to harvest all this wood during the summer and the fall, and you stack it all in here, and then it's gonna last you all winter. But you don't want it to get wet because you can't burn wet wood, and you don't want it to rot. So they've got it up off the ground. They've got a little stone base here, very practical. It's because if you put wood by the ground, it absorbs moisture and it rots. But if you put stone where it intersects with the ground and then you put the wood above that, and you also get the air moving under there, so it's getting a lot of ventilation. If it gets a little blowing rain or something, then it dries out because it's got air. The warm air rises through here and is exhausted out that little canopy at the top so that there's constant air movement that's keeping all that wood dry and in good shape for burning. Practical, sensible, logical, and in a certain way, simple and elegant and authentic and truly beautiful. Now, just to show a different expression of those same values of humanism, in a completely different context, this is a very wealthy family, the Gamble family. So we now have P&G, Procter & Gamble, huge multinational corporation. Probably the deodorant you put on this morning was Procter & Gamble. Probably if you sprayed your hair, it was Procter & Gamble. If you dusted with
some spray goop. That was probably Procter & Gamble. So it was the Gamble family from that famous company. And they were based in Cincinnati. And so this wealthy family in Cincinnati kind of had an epiphany. Number one, the dad in the family was having respiratory problems. And his doctor said, you need to go to a really healthy climate, something like Arizona or Southern California, where it's warm, you don't have the cold weather to deal with, it's not damp. So they decided, okay, we're gonna move to Southern California. And they moved to Pasadena, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And they're a wealthy family. Damn, they could have built a badass, Mediterranean mansion or a Tudor castle. They could have done anything they wanted. They had more money than God. But they go out there and they realize maybe we just want to live a healthy, simpler life than we were living in Cincinnati. Maybe we want to invest in some of these notions of humanism. Now, they're not making a little, farmer's cottage here. They're not quite to Henry David Thoreau, who was another great humanist, who went out to Walden Pond and lived a very simple life when he decided to do this. But they are sort of toning down and making a different kind of lifestyle. So they move out to Southern California. They again use very plain materials. This is redwood, which there's an abundance of redwood in California. They're using stones that are collected from the Arroyo Seca, which is a riverbed nearby, and they're integrating it with these overburned bricks, which actually are refuse bricks from the brick-making process. Their architects, Charles and Henry Green, are local guys here who just have an appreciation of the climate. This salubrious, beautiful climate doesn't get too hot in the summer, doesn't get too cold in the winter. This is long before LA smog or anything like that. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous climate there. So they build a house that's all about the local materials, beautifully crafted, very sensible construction, where you can see every detail of the wood and how it's put together. They have these sleeping porches off of every bedroom so that you actually roll your bed out there and you can sleep outdoors for much of the year. Lots of places to dine outdoors off the dining room, a little dining terrace out there, constantly catching every breeze, engaged with this beautiful green landscape of Southern California, made of this very soft, very gentle wood and shingles and in framing. All of that creating an environment that's gentle, authentic, nurturing, about comfort, about your life, not about showing off, but about really your everyday life, simple, beautiful pleasures of a cooling breeze or watching the stars as you're going to sleep or sitting and having a chat with someone or enjoying a good meal. These simple things are generating this architecture of humanism, both at a technical and construction scale and also at a lifestyle scale. Now, that begins to germinate in Southern California. Charles and Henry Green were extremely influential, and a whole genre of houses began to crop up that are, we often call them craftsman-style houses or bungalows these days. There also were furniture makers. These are by a guy named Gustav Stickley, and he made a whole line of furniture that was meant to have those same values. Sturdy, simple, made of that redwood that was so abundant there in California. Comfortable, stuffing that had leather. Leather, which is like your skin. It's like you when you're touching leather. It gives with you. It's got the same temperature as your skin. Things like rocking chairs. There's something in your body that loves that rhythm of rocking, like the rhythm of your heartbeat. So that comforting kind of thing revived rocking chairs, which had been kind of forgotten for a really long period of time before that. Big, thick arms there, so you can really rest your arm there, and made sturdy so that they last a long time. Super practical furniture. And the Stickleys then started to do interior design and imagine these much more
practical interiors. This was an era in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where Victorian style was rampant. So people had tons and tons of gewgaws and stained glass and plants and stuff in their houses. And the Stickleys, although this still looks like a fair amount of stuff to us, they would pare that down. No, it's better to have a simpler life, all about humanism. Now, that morphed into, in the 20th century, notions that we sometimes call functionalism or modernism. Alvar Aalto, who we looked at last lecture, and we looked at Baker House, this building right here, and there's that dining room on the lower floor, there's the living room on the upper floor, and the overlook that connects the two of them in this big stair, and that ritual of dining down below and then coming up after dinner and having coffee and having conversation. So the whole ethos functionally is very humanistic. But then if we kind of hone down to details, look at that handrail right there. And it's actually made out of wood, a beautiful piece of maple wood, a local wood to New England. And it's shaped so that you put the heel of your hand on it and you wrap your fingers around it. It's not circular. It actually is shaped like your hand. So when you touch it, it responds to your physiognomy. Here's another handrail in Baker House. Again, you see that place where you wrap your fingers around there, the heel of your hand there, and it just takes the shape of your hand. And for Aalto, that's how people and buildings should interact. It should be a material that is the temperature of your body, which wood is. He thought that wood had a grain, like the grain in your muscles. Muscles have this kind of linear grain to them. Wood has this linear grain to it. So there's something in wood that is like us, like our body, and there's a kind of humanistic reaction there. This is a house that Aalto did back in Finland in 1939. This is comparable to that gamble house in that this was for about the wealthiest person in Finland, Merta Gulliksen. Her family owned this huge cellulose factories. That was the biggest industry in Finland at the time. And so he's doing this house for this very wealthy woman, but he makes a very comfortable, homey house built around a fireplace here. He did most of the furniture, these pieces of furniture there. Very comfortable furniture. But here's an example of this notion of humanism. So it's a pretty big house, and sometimes they have kind of large parties. So you need big open spaces. So he's using steel for framing because the steel has longer spans and allows him to get those larger open spaces. So we have two steel columns here. But he realizes that, again, we're in Finland. It's cold there. If I'm at a party and I start to lean against that column, that steel is going to be freezing cold on my skin. That's going to be uncomfortable. So he wraps the column in leather from there to there. At any height that people would touch it, it's wrapped in leather. Leather being skin, like us, the temperature of your body, the character of your body, the texture that would be much nicer to touch than the steel would be. That's this notion of humanism. Now, this is that's a Ferdinand Leger painting right over here. There's a Degas dancer. I mean, these people have this phenomenal, expensive art collection. These things aren't in contradiction, the sort of high art and this everyday life. But for Merete Gulliksen and for Aalto, everyday life was phenomenally important. And that needed to be front and center in the design, as well as kind of high art notions of these great paintings. A couple of details that Aalto designed. The one on the left is in a house he did for Monsieur Le Carré, just outside Paris in Bazoche. This was one of the most famous art dealers in the world, but Monsieur Carré was an old man by the time he had Aalto design his house, and he was a little feeble. So all of the door handles, Alto's thinking about this older guy who kind of has a hard time gripping a regular doorknob. And a regular doorknob, when you think about it, it's not all that well designed. If your hand is a little slippery or a little wet, it's hard to get traction on that doorknob. And if you don't have a good grip, like Monsieur Carré did not, then it's hard to get traction on that knob. So he does a lever instead of a knob in the house. And he designs all these levers to replace the knobs. And they're made out of brass, and they have just the shape of your hand. If you start to grasp something, your thumb and your first finger have a tighter radius than your pinky, which has much less strength and has a broader radius. So the shape of that lever is tight where your thumb and your first finger are, and it gets broader as it goes to your pinky. And your pinky would then sit right there, and there's a little notch out so you won't slide off the lever. So it'll stop your hand from sliding off. And then, of course, the brass is there because it's strong and it needs to be durable. But again, touching the brass on a cold day, just a little uncomfortable. So he wraps it again in leather with this beautiful braid of leather, both to give you a little more traction. It's not slippery like the metal would be. And also to give you warmth there as you touch the handle. That is the most detailed humanist design. Here's another door pull. This one is in a bookstore in downtown Helsinki, Stockmann's Bookstore. So this is the biggest bookstore in Finland. The Finns love their books. And so this is Mecca for a lot of Finns who like to read. And of course, they're old people, young people. There are a lot of Finns that are super tall, like 6'4 plus. Finnish guys tend to be big guys. And then you got little kids because there's a children's department. So Aalto thinks, well, you know, it's not right to have a door pull at the height that's right for medium-sized people. What about little people? What about tall people? So he actually makes three door pulls, one for tall people, one for medium-sized people, one for little kids, and stacks them up there so it's just right for you to grab no matter what height you are. And the door pull is specifically designed for the way your body would grab a door pull. So if you reach out and grab something, if I reach out and grab that coffee cup, my hand is not vertical. That's not natural. Because the way my shoulder, my elbow, my wrist are designed, it's more natural to grab it at an angle like this. So grabbing it vertically like that is not a natural way to grab it. So he doesn't make the handle vertical. He makes it at that slight angle that's just natural for your body when you reach out and grab something. So this is at the tiniest detail humanistic design. Now, just to make you know that it's not just Aalto that can do those beautiful, beautiful details, but we looked a couple of times ago at the Exeter Library by Lou Kahn, and I showed these two slides. And this is a bit of beautiful humanistic design by Lou Kahn. So here we have a little study carrel. And he's designed a little space over here for your backpack or your extra books. Designed a nice working surface right there. You get light in from the outside. There's a clear story window up above here that lets general light in the room. But you get specific light right there on your working surface. It also gives you a little place to look out, a little window just your size to look out there. Now, if you want not to be distracted while you're at the study carrel, then you just slide the panel over. That panel slides over, and it blocks out that view. So if you want a little more intense study, the shape of that right there, when you lean back like this guy is doing, you can see somebody walking by here. But if you sort of do a little heads down, you know, really into the studying, then this blocks your view and you have a much more private area there. So he's thought about what's it like to study intensely, what's it like to get a little relief from a view, what's it like to be able to see passersby or be separate from passersby. All of those things are built into the design of that simple little study area. Aalto, in fact, designed a lot of furniture in my house. I have four Aalto pieces, three of the four are authentic ones from, you know, original, like now antique kind of alto pieces. They're just exquisitely designed, magnificent. So at the time, there was an interest in furniture design is in what's called functional design. And that would have been a chair designed by Marcel Breuer in the Bauhaus. This one's called the Vasily chair because he designed it for Vasily Kandinsky, a famous painter at the Bauhaus. And that was meant to be a very functionalist design. It was functional because they were thinking of the whole manufacturing process, and they were thinking also of the practicality of moving furniture around in your house. So instead of a big, you know, heavy, overstuffed chair that would be hard to move around, hard to manufacture, hard to get to your house, I was thinking of how do I make something lightweight, easy to manufacture, easy to move in and out. And he was inspired by his bicycle. He saw all the tubular steel, super strong on his bicycle, but lightweight. So he decided, I'm going to make a piece of furniture out of that tubular steel, chromium-plated tubular steel, and then I'm just going to have canvas or leather that would stretch back and forth there to make the seat and the back and the arms. It's very practical to make, very sensible, easily manufactured, very lightweight, easy to move around in your house or when you move from one place to another. And Aalto said, yes, that is functional from a technical point of view. But he said that is not functional from a humanistic point of view. That steel is too cold. It's cold to the eye and it's cold to the touch. That stretched leather or canvas doesn't give with your body the way your body wants to be received. The shape is all straight lines. Your body is full of curvy, funny, you know, not straight lines. So Aalto designed this chair on the right, and he made it also of very sophisticated technology. This is plywood. It's lots of little plies of wood, little thin strips. They would soak them, get the grain of it very soft, and then they would layer them up and put glue in between the layers, and then they would put them on a form that makes exactly that curvy shape that interacts with your body. So the shape of that has your wrist up here and your hand wrapping over. It has your elbow right there. And then it has two strong supports that hold up the chair. The actual part that your body sits on is the shape of your back and your butt and your knee. There is a little dip right there that's like the shape of your back. Everything in the chair is responding to the physiognomy of your body. Because it's lightweight, made of this super strong industrial version of wood, but now also wood that is the grain of your muscles, that is the temperature of your body, that has now been shaped to react to your body. From Aalto's point of view, now it's functional from a technical and a humanistic point of view. Okay. We've seen that in sort of smaller scale. And actually, a lot of the way humanism works is at that detailed scale, you know, really where the body meets the building. But let's zoom out a little more and look at those same considerations in whole buildings. This one is Paimio Sanatorium in a little town called Paimio, Finland. It's near Turku. It was done by Alvar Aalto in 1929 to 1933. And he won this in a competition. He's a relatively young architect. He's in his 20s when he won this competition. And the way they would do that is anybody could enter the competition and whatever was the best design won. And so he, even though he didn't have the experience, he had good ideas and he won a number of these competitions when he was in his 20s. So the idea of this sanatorium is this is for people with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was a horrible, horrible disease at the time. Some people called it consumption, but that was it killed people all over the world. It's a respiratory illness. It's highly contagious. And it would just, when they would have an epidemic of this, it would just sweep through whole towns and kill people. So when someone got tuberculosis because it was so contagious, they tended to separate them from everyone else and put them in a sanatorium. So this was a place where when somebody would get tuberculosis, they'd be sent to the sanatorium, and everybody here would be tuberculin patients. And they couldn't be visited very much by their families because the disease was so contagious. So this is a horrible thing. You've not only got tuberculosis, but now you're separated from your family, and you have to live apart from society. So he's thinking, how can I make these people's lives as good as I possibly can? How can I help compensate for this horrible disease they've got? So the building is made as a kind of village of parts. It's on a beautiful site in a rural area, so there are beautiful views out to the forest. That was great that it was given such a good site. But then he actually divides it into a wing that's the patient's rooms, a wing that is the sort of common spaces, the dining room, the craft rooms, the exam rooms for the doctors, a kind of connector wing that's all about circulation and service, and then in the back, the kitchen and other utility kinds of spaces. And he takes that long bar and he gives every single room a southeast orientation. So that means that when you wake up in the morning, the sun is going to be coming in from the southeast. And he thought of a person's day. When I wake up in the morning, I'm in Finland. The sun is precious in Finland. They don't have long hours of sun off in the winter. It's a very short day. You want every bit of that sun. So you give them the sun in the morning when they wake up, and that's probably the time when they're spending in their room, doing their morning ablutions, getting ready, and so on. So it is oriented southeast to maximize that ideal sun in the morning. And then there also is a kind of recreation area. Many people wouldn't be infirm. They'd be able to take a walk. So they could go out, and there's a place for a walk here and a view to the forest here. So all the people in the rooms can watch their neighbors walking and can look out to the forest, and there's a very nice view and the perfect sun orientation to the southeast. Now, that piece of the building is cranked over due south, because now, in the middle of the day, you go for lunch in the dining room or you go for dinner in the dining room. That's got craft areas, so these common spaces where you might go and do things, take classes, do things with your fellow patients. And then in the back here is the more utility and service kinds of areas that serve that dining room and the common areas right there. So we have all of those patient rooms, every one with the perfect orientation and the perfect sun condition and view. Then this one, which is showing the ground floor where the exam rooms are, above that would be the dining rooms. This is that circulation pod, and then the kitchen and utility areas back there. In that patient wing, every room has a nice big window, and you see the collection of all those windows. On the other side is just a corridor, and it's got a completely different expression of the corridor over there. In the dining room, we've got these big, generous windows, and they're looking out to people coming and going in the front court there. They've got that horizontal sunshade so that it's getting all the sun they possibly can get in the wintertime, but excluding the sun in the summertime. A terrace off the dining room so that they can spill out and enjoy the outdoors while they're dining in certain times of the year. And then these craft rooms up above, right there. The kitchen, even the kitchen, extremely thoughtful. Skylights over the prep areas in the center of the kitchen so that there's plenty of light even on the work surfaces of the people who are preparing the meals. And then all the exhaust to make sure that they don't have too much collection of heat in the kitchens and so on. But the place where you really feel Aalto's humanism is in the patient room. So turned out Aalto had a skiing accident shortly before he did the design for this building. And it was a pretty serious skiing accident. He broke his leg really badly. And at that point, the way they dealt with that was to put you in traction. So he was actually in traction for 6 weeks, laying flat on his back in a bed with his leg propped up for 6 weeks. And so he said in that period of time, he learned what it was like to be a horizontal person. Most of us walk around through life as a vertical person. But he found out how it was to lay in the bed and be a horizontal person. And many of the people who were the ones that were seriously ill would have to be horizontal people. They'd be confined to their bed. So he's thinking, how do we design for a horizontal person? So one thing is that he made the windows really high so that when you're lying in bed, you can see out. So the window is up there, whereas just windows here are very hard for you. You have to crank your head around to see out there. He put the light fixture not in the middle of the room, where it's incredibly annoying to have the glare of a fixture in the middle of the room. Instead, it's back up behind the bed. He put the color not on the walls, but on the ceiling. So the walls are actually white, but the ceiling in this room is turquoise, very nice, interesting color. So when you're looking up, you're not looking at boring, you're looking at a nice color. He put the heating, instead of it being, and if you've been sedentary, you've been in a hospital or something like that, it's so annoying blowing air. Oh my God, it drives you nuts. And that's the way most heating and air conditioning is delivered. You blow air. So instead he said, look, where everybody's in their bed a lot here, we're not having blowing air. So instead he used what's called radiant heating, where they have pipes going through the ceiling right here, and they're heating up a metal panel, and that's radiating heat in that part of the room so that it's not blowing air, and that's what's the heater for the room. The heat is placed so that it's at the end of the bed. When you're lying in bed, what gets cold the fastest? Your feet. So he puts the heater near your feet. Your torso doesn't get nearly as cold as your feet do. So he acknowledges that in the location of the radiant heating there. He wants to be able to deliver natural breezes into the room, natural ventilation. But he doesn't want a draft because it's a respiratory illness. If you catch a cold or something like that, it can easily turn into pneumonia. So he wants to ventilate the room, but you can't get a draft. So he designs these elaborate casement windows where one piece operates out and the other piece operates in. So the air can come between those two windows in that way, but it can't blow on the patient directly like that. So the heating, the color, the light, the view, the ventilation, everything is being super thoughtful about this vulnerable patient in the bed. So another thing that is common of tuberculosis patients is because it's a respiratory illness, your lungs get filled up with mucus. And so sometimes you get congested. And one of the ways that you get uncongested is to hawk and spit. So you go like, right? That would be how they get the phlegm out of their throat. And if you're a patient in this room, you might have to get up and go over to the sink and hawk and spit several times in an hour. So he thought, wow, we've got to really make, and there's a sink in the room right there, convenient. But he thought of, most sinks, when you turn them on and the water comes out, he was very annoyed by the fact they often splash back up at you. So the water comes out the spigot, hits the sink, and splashes back up at you. And he thought, okay, we can take that if you're doing that three times a day. But if I'm doing that four or five times an hour, this is going to get really annoying. So can I make a sink that doesn't splash? So he made the spigot come out like a gooseneck there. And then he made the surface of the sink a very steep slope back. So the water hit the steep slope back and went into the drain and didn't bounce out on the patient. Just thoughtful redesign of this common accoutrement. But where he had tuberculosis patients, he had a special need he had to deal with. Lots and lots of terraces throughout, these places where people could go out and take the sun. Very bright, cheerful feeling inside. Lots of light, lots of bright, cheerful color. It's all red and white in the dining room. It's all yellow and white in the public spaces. It's generally turquoise and white in the rooms. Bright, cheerful colors, trying to pep people up a little bit. The whole notion here is humanism. How do we try to get self-actualization even for someone in a tough situation like this? How do we get comfort? How do we get practicality? Okay, they got a hawk and spit. What's a practical way to deal with that problem? How do we deal with, you know, your feet being cold? How do you deal with avoiding breezes? How do we try to make them as comfortable as we possibly can? So that was in a tuberculosis sanatorium. A completely different function here. At pretty much the same time, he wins another design competition to do a library in the little town of Vipuri, just on the Russian border in Finland. And this is a completely different challenge, different design challenge. But he's applying these same notions of humanism there. So again, he's thinking of the function of the building. There was to be a lecture hall and meeting room in the library. There were some administrative offices they had to have. There's the reading room, there's the stacks, there's, you know, all these different functions. So again, he kind of separates them out into separate volumes. On the ground floor here is that lecture hall, right by the entrance, so people can come and go easily to it, even when the library is closed. So the lecture hall's there. You go up the stairs, and the administrative offices are on the top right there, right through here. You go straight through in the entrance, and there's the big reading room right there. And that's that space that we'll look at in some detail. Now, for Aalto, if you're talking about libraries and you're in Finland, one of the things you got to think about is the light. How can you maximize the light for reading in a library? And this was Aalto's evaluation. So he said, you know, I'm reading a book, and I got a light here, and I've got the book at just the right angle so I don't get any glare on the page from the light. And I sit there and I read for a little while, maybe 10 minutes, and my body tells me, Larry, I just got to move. You know, your body doesn't like to stay exactly stationary, so I've got the perfect optimized reading position here, but my body wants to fidget. So I start to move, and then I've got glare on the page, and then I have to adjust the light. And then, you know, it's not about having a single place where all this works. You need to have flexibility so your body can move, and you still don't get glare on that page. So he's thinking, how can I get super even lighting, very diffuse lighting in this reading room? So it doesn't matter whether you're standing up and you're looking for the book on the bookshelf, or you've pulled the book out and you're trying to read it right there, or you're sitting in a chair and you're reading in one position and then you shift your weight and you read in another position, there's going to be even no glare light everywhere in this library. So he makes this big, tall space, and he puts skylights at the top of it there, and these are 6 feet in diameter. The maximum height the sun ever gets in the summertime at noon in Finland is 52 degrees. So the sun is always low in the sky. You never get direct sun from above. So these are deep enough that you never get direct sun in. It always comes and bounces and gives diffuse light in that space. But you've got the whole ceiling full of that indirect illumination. And that's lighting the book stacks when you're looking at them. And it's lighting everywhere where you read. And he's making these little sketches. It says no shadows, no reflection, no shadows. And he even does artificial lighting to mimic the natural lighting that he's bringing in. So even at night, you get that kind of diffusion of the light. And that's what those big skylights look like in the ceiling. And they light all of the reading room spaces on two levels there. Very clever device where he splits the level. So normally in a library, you can only reach up so far to the bookshelves. So he makes kind of two levels intersecting so he can get that full height of bookshelves and then get the full height of bookshelves again around the perimeter. And there's a circulation desk that kind of looks over all of that, and very easy access to a librarian or to help if you need it. Then in the lecture hall, it's a completely different thing. Now it's not all about light. Lecture halls are all about sound. How do I distribute the sound? And you got to think, we're in the 1930s here. They don't have speaker systems and amplified sound like we have now. So he's trying to make it so the speaker can talk to an audience. They can hear his speech in a natural way without amplification. And then all the rustling and moving of papers and feet, you want to reduce that sound and you want to emphasize the speaker's voice. So he makes this really kinky ceiling that's very curvy like that. And where the speaker is here, every piece of that curvy ceiling that's facing the speaker is a reflective surface. So the sound goes out and gets reflected down to the ears of the listener. And every piece that is not facing the speaker but is facing the audience is an absorptive surface. So when you fidget or you make noise or you cough, that is absorbed and it's diminished in the room. So the speaker's voice is reflected and amplified, and all the noise in the room is muffled and diffused and absorbed. And that allowed them to have a very natural amplification of the speaker's voice without any kind of artificial means. Now, this notion of humanism is a cultural thing. I don't know. Think about it. Are we in a humanistic era now? Do we think about our comfort and practicality? And do we think about self-actualization? Do we really optimize all those things? Definitely in Finland, in this era, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, there was a lot of emphasis on that. And even to this day, all these polls they do about where are the happiest people in the world, they're always freaking in Scandinavia, like Denmark and Finland and Sweden, because they're really concerned about comfort and practicality and reason and self-actualization and the dignity and worth of mankind. They've been into this for quite a long time. And Aalto wasn't alone in this. There were other architects very, very adamant about this that were contemporaries of his. One of them is a guy named Eric Brickman. He actually was a good friend of Aalto's. They even shared an office for a while in Turku. And in the 1940s, he did this funeral chapel. So this is about a very tender, vulnerable moment in human existence. People have lost a loved one. How do you make the architecture comfort them? How do you make the architecture soothe them in this moment of turmoil? So the chapel is located in a funeral park, beautiful, beautiful trees, lovely woods outside the chapel. And Brickman orients the whole building to a glass wall that looks out to that beautiful landscape. Just this serene, quiet, soothing landscape. And then he makes the lines of the room very soft and curving. He even brings natural growth and vegetation into the building. All the light is very indirect, bouncing off of surfaces. The color of the room is a very kind of soft green, almost like it's just the reflection of the color of the forest. And you feel like you're maybe in a little clearing in the forest. It's a rectangular room, but the pews are put at an angle so that as you're sitting there, you can see the altar, you can see the body which is placed there, you can see the eulogist or the speaker, but you also can see out to nature so that it isn't like it's off somewhere else. You're aimed at the natural environment as well as the focus of the ceremony at the front of the room. The color, the shape, the quality of the space is all about soothing, dignified reassurance at this moment of vulnerability. And there is an incredible humanistic notion there of just how you deal with the design of buildings. Aalto's own life was all dedicated to this. This is his house in a suburb of Helsinki. Very modest house, very comfortable. Lived there, raised his kids, had his whole life in this one simple little house. Very famous architect, but it wasn't like, dude, look how crazy-ass architect I am. No, simple house. This is his office, which he could walk to just down the street. Little amphitheater where they could sit and have their lunch there. Just a great, pleasant working environment. Okay, so the Twitter card question for today. I want to know, where are your values on this notion of humanism? You might even think of those two high boards, the fancy pants one and the plain one. Or think of the buildings we've been looking at. Do you think that form should come from just issues of form? Or do you think this notion of humanism should be a fundamental informing element in the making of architectural form? How important do you think this notion of humanism for you is for you or for the kind of environments you want to inhabit? And again, totally honest. If you think, yeah, I'm not interested in this, let us have it. Just whatever you think.